This would be the sociology, the job of the sociology of knowledge in the enlightened sense to which Professor Sorokin has contributed so much. And on the other hand, we have the more philosophical problem, namely to deal with the level of symbolic relations on the basis of a certain clarified philosophical issue. But if we take this idea into consideration, that symbols are it themselves socially approved, socially derived, and an element of the reality of our social life, although they refer to a transcendent reality, then it seems to me that most of the speakers in these discussions could find a common ground.
Lyman Bryson is the kind of person who is able to accomplish such heroic tasks as summing up a discussion of many-sidedness. On this occasion, I venture to say a stimulating and fruitful discussion. Mr. Bryson.
This is a task I never should have chosen for myself. I think it's a great pity to seem to discard a great deal of richness in the discussion of a very complex subject. All I can do, since I will not attempt to repeat what other people have said, is to try to state what I think that complex subject was, or perhaps better, to state what I think is our present dialectic position. I think what we're trying to get at is in the first place, what makes an effective or a dynamically effective symbol in social and political action. I'd like to call your attention to the fact, which may of course just been because of lack of time, that nobody referred back to the discussion yesterday, which means that you leave out, I think, one of the aspects which affects this subject as well as this more special subject of yesterday. And I can put it best in terms of a fable, as Dr. Finkelstein suggests. Mr. Selig Hecht, one of my most lamented lost friends, once said that you don't understand the progress of science from most of the histories of science and most of its discussions because they all leave out the toolmaker. They leave out the man who invents the actual instrument, either intellectual or physical, by which people with new synthesizing power, new investigative imaginations, can take a step forward. And it seems to me that that's the only thing you have specifically and importantly left out of this discussion. What we were talking yesterday was the toolmaker in the symbolic process. I think that was left out. But now, with that comment, what we have been trying to do here, all of us, I think, was to come to terms with a difficulty which lies in antitheses of this kind, beginning with Professor Franck's extremely interesting idea that physical and social patterns, constructive patterns, tend to reflect one another and operate in cycles. We went on to a suggestion that the dynamics of politics is not symbolically, is not affected successfully by symbol unless the symbol is personalized, which launched us in a question of what kind of person, alive or dead? And if dead, is it the fact that his name remains and our concept of him, as Professor Sorokin quite properly pointed out, and I didn't mean to deny that, may change? And that leads us to ask if it is an idea behind this personalized symbol, which remaining continues to give it force. But now, suggesting the dialectic aspect of this, it's certainly true, isn't it? And this was said by some people in slightly different language, that Jefferson and Lincoln continue to be active and dynamic symbols in American political life, though the content of those symbols has changed enormously. It isn't necessary, is it, to point out the absurdity of supposing that the present Republican Party represents the ideas of Abraham Lincoln, or that the present Democratic Party represents the political tenets or philosophy of Thomas Jefferson. The disparity is all too evident. But the force of the symbol, of the person, remains. Now, is this because these men are human beings, as was suggested, and although the monument doesn't make them human beings, Mount Vernon does make Washington a human being, and the monument of Lincoln makes him one, and Monticello makes Jefferson one. Or is it because, and again, we are, I think, here in a dialectic difference, is it because they are not human beings? And not being human beings, they continue to have a power, which if we knew more about them, they wouldn't have. Which brings me to say that exactly the same situation lies in the area of language, or taking language as a system of symbols of greatest power. Is it because words can be made very specific that they're so powerful as symbols? They can be very precise as a flag or a gesture or a speech or a poem cannot. Or is it precisely for the opposite effect that they're so effective as symbols, that the great words of a great poet or a great orator have all kinds, and I'm now borrowing a word from the discussion, adumbrations of meaning, which cannot be pinned down and which allow a number of people to be moved toward the same action, not because they agree, not because they put the same idea into the symbol, but because the symbol moves them, because it has a kind of inclusive quality which embraces all of their sanctions and all of their ideas. It seems to me that we are constantly balancing these two ideas. The symbol is valuable because it is precise, because it's a rifle, it's an arrow to the mark. The symbol is valuable and useful because it isn't, because it's a shotgun, because it's a flag waving in the breeze. And I don't know how you people have made up your mind between these two ideas, because we have oscillated between them constantly. Is the idea behind a symbol what gives it its strength? In that case, how does one explain the fact that some symbols represent unifying power, political dynamism, which is our subject, what we're talking about, in spite of the fact that the content of that symbol constantly changes, and the change is unconsciously made by the people who go ahead moving in actual physical events, which are not mere ideas. Well, I withdraw the mere. They're not ideas. And political parties are a very good example. Or the British Empire, Mr. Adam, is an excellent example, because the symbol of the Queen, around which, because the Queen is so human or not human at all, whichever it may be, the symbol of empire there has been a dynamism, has been an energy in political action, which has changed its direction, its idea of its direction, of its purpose, over and over again in the history of the effect of the symbol. Now, does that mean that as long as there is an idea, the symbol is effective? Or, as has been suggested by some of you, and you take a very strong position on this, the idea must be consistent, continuous, and true. And if true, what does one mean by truth? Mr. Wright said, we all know there is the truth which is true whether or not we believe it, and there's the truth that is true because we believe it. Nobody has any difficulty with that, Mr. Wright. But we all have a great deal of difficulty, except in the common sense world, to decide whether this truth, which is true, whether we believe it or not, is accessible to the instruments that we have for determining it. That's where the difficulty begins. And as far as a symbol is concerned, does it matter whether it's true, whether anybody believes it or not, or does it matter because people believe it? And there again, it seems to me, one has to make a choice between two quite different attitudes toward the world. Now, are we doing anything more here? In spite of what you say, Dr. Schutz, which I agree with, there's a basic kind of congruence here in our ideas. Are we doing anything more than expressing in various ways and with various materials of expression the basic difference, the basic distinction, which has marked the deliberations of this conference, Mr. Chairman, from the very beginning? I would like to call attention with complete reverence to the fact that a historical event took place the other day in Washington of the highest significance to American philosophical life. Senator McCarthy made his first philosophical statement. And it is precisely on the point that we've been talking about. He said, these are my words, I don't want to agree with people who differ with me on principle. I don't want anybody to work with me who differs with me on principle. I should say that of all the things I have heard Senator McCarthy say since the beginning of his oratory, that's the one with which I most profoundly disagree. Because I happen to be on one side of this distinction that I'm talking about, which we've talked about before. We are divided, and every group of us, scientist, artist, philosopher, religionist, and everybody else, is divided into two kinds of people. Those who say, if your ultimate sanctions and ideas are the same as mine, then I want to work with you. And if they aren't, then I'm going to continue to be suspicious of you, and I'm going to work with reluctance. And the others who say, your ultimate sanctions and ideas are your own business, which I'm quite willing to discuss with you with tolerance and friendliness, but if you'll work with me, then that, for that matter, doesn't make any difference. Now, I'd like to call your attention to the fact that on both sides of this question are very distinguished people of very distinguished kinds and very different kinds. Mr. Jacques Maritain, for instance, with his great eminence as a Catholic philosopher, is one of those that I would call a democrat of the spirit. He has said, he said it in Mexico City at a UNESCO conference, in the affairs of life, in the material existence that we have, we must work with people without asking them whether their ultimate sanctions for what we consider good is the same as ours. And we've had people in these conferences say exactly the opposite, and I'm sorry that they are on Senator McCarthy's side, because I think most of them would regret that fact. I think the convergence of their ideas and Mr. McCarthy's would displease them, but it happens to be true. Now, that seems to me what we are still talking about when we talk about the effect of symbols in political life. Do we believe that the power of the symbol comes from the fact that men will believe it and act on it, and what kind of a symbol will make them do that? Or do we believe that the power of the symbol lies in the fact that whether they believe it or not, the power represents an idea which has a continuing, external, transcendent reality in it? I've, by implication, Mr. Chairman, stated my own position on this, and I've done it because I think that makes a little more clear what I think is the dialectic situation in which we still are, which we always have been, and I suspect always will be. And the discussion of the symbol has brought us, I think, closer to an understanding of that difference.
Thank you, Lyman. You will notice that this afternoon is free for repose, recreation, or reflection, either individually or in groups, and that the next session will be the evening session, a general session on the section on philosophy and religion, of which Mr. Faust is the chairman. The meeting is adjourned.
Robert, did I go? Thank you very much.